This is the Lane 9 podcast, a production of Lane 9 Project, which is a community focused on the intersection of running and disordered eating at all levels of sport. We share your stories, we chat with practitioners and coaches, and we work on shifting the norms in sport toward healthier relationships with food, body, and movement. I'm Heather Kaplan. I co-founded Lane 9 Project with Alexis Fairbanks. Today, I'm chatting with Kara Bozzi, who's a co-founder of Opal Food and Body Wisdom, an eating disorder treatment center in Seattle that incorporates athletics and sport into their treatment model. We talk about her story as an athlete in basketball and then competitive collegiate running in the 3K and 5K, her experiences with disordered eating, and how that eventually informed and inspired her work with athletes, both in private practice as a therapist and eventually through Opal's treatment model. A disclaimer: Kara and I are both practitioners, but we are not your practitioners. So the content of this episode is intended for conversation and awareness. It is not intended to, nor should it, replace individual medical nutrition therapy, psychotherapy, or medical care. Talk to your providers and/or your team before making any changes. And just a quick note about some of the language that we use in this episode. Kara mentions that her private practice with co-founder Julie Church was essentially a, quote, makeshift IOP, end quote. But what's an IOP? It stands for Intensive Outpatient Program. In most cases, these programs include 3 to 5 days a week of therapeutic sessions, such as, again, psychotherapy or talk therapy, nutrition sessions with a dietitian, sometimes group therapy, and sometimes group meals. And that usually takes 3 to 5 hours per day, 3 to 5 days a week, give or take, depending on the facility model and/or the client needs. This is part of the higher levels of care in eating disorder treatment models. And by, quote, outpatient care, we mean folks who may see a dietitian, therapist, psychiatrist, and or primary care physician weekly, biweekly, or monthly as part of their ongoing care, or maybe their only care. So that might be as they transition out of these higher levels of care, or sometimes that's just the care that folks receive or that they set up for themselves. I hope that makes sense. Happy to answer questions about it. I just wanted to acknowledge that we use some kind of jargon or common lingo in the eating disorder space, but maybe some folks don't know what that means. All right. All of that said, here we go. Hi, Kara. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and just dive right in with your athletic story, and then we'll get into the work that you're doing now through Opal. But if we rewind, tell us a little bit about getting into sports as a kid and what that felt like for you.
Yeah, so I was a multi-sport athlete, started sports as a little one, and did kind of everything. Soccer, basketball, swim team. So I was, you know, I had a lot of pleasure for sport, a high appetite for movement. Obviously, I didn't have that language for back then. was a really active kid. And then really, I mean, my first love, true love, was basketball. So that was the sport I very much invested in, played club basketball year round, and then did other sports in addition to basketball. So I started running when I was in eighth grade. I did track and then did cross country and track in high school and then basketball. So the three sport athlete, and did basketball kind of all year round with club. So those was a very big part of my life.
Yeah.
Very big part of my identity as a young person and adolescent. Yeah.
How did you get into running? Speaking personally, I feel like a lot of the ball sport people, which I played soccer, so I'm a ball sport person. I'm like, running? No, that sounds exhausting. And I think I went to one track practice in middle school and was like, oh no,
Yeah,
not doing that.
So interestingly, the reason I got into running actually became pretty significant later in my story, but my mom was an only child, and her cousin, who she was really close with, all of her kids were runners and actually really like good runners. And so it was sort of, running's in our genetics, why don't you give it a try? And I think, you know, I did care quite a bit about being good and being successful at sport. And so that was sort of the introduction of, you should give track a try. And I really actually didn't like track. I started cross country my freshman year of high school, and that I really enjoyed because of the community of cross country and my teammates. We made it to state my freshman year. I was, I think, the number three runner on my team, or maybe even number two runner on my team for freshman year at state. And it was just this very fun experience. So I loved cross country. And then every track season I wanted to quit. Actually, I didn't do track my freshman year. And then I kind of got encouraged by coaches to do track. And I was kind of a brat. I was always trying to quit it. Like, I don't want to do it this year. So I didn't like the exposure of track, you know, being so visible, and the performance anxiety that came with that was hard. And I didn't feel as much of the sense of community on the track team as I did with cross country. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that might be one of my very few regrets growing up, is that I didn't even try cross country. I had one of my teachers was the cross country coach. So he was always trying to recruit soccer players, but it was the same season for us. So if we had done cross country, we would have to give up soccer. And like, there was no way that was happening. But I feel like now I really appreciate it as a sport for what it gives like young folks as a community, a team, something where you don't feel like you're performing and people are just watching you and you're just like running through the woods most of the time. So yeah. Like, that sounds great, you know? Yeah.
It is. I really love the cross country community, and, you know, yeah. Doing it myself as an athlete for a lot of years, and then being, you know, transitioning, my husband's a coach, he's coached cross country and track. So we've had that sport in our life since I was in eighth grade, basically. And now my kids are doing it. And I just think that community, every time fall rolls around with kind of the start of the fall, the smells of the fall, the cooler air, the grass, I just am like, cross country season, it's the best. I love it.
Yeah. And then you went into college and you were a collegiate athlete. Did you do both track and cross country, or one or the other?
Actually, I had hopes to play college basketball. That was, and that is a big part of my sports story as well, of having a really negative and challenging experience with my basketball coach, and like a pretty traumatic experience, honestly, where then I ended up stopped playing basketball. And it was the same kind of family lineage of my mom's cousin's family that led to the University of Washington coach reaching out to me in high school. And basically I was a recruited walk-on because he was recruiting me on potential. And sort of, he loved my second cousin or first cousin once removed. I don't know what she would be considered. Yeah. She was an athlete on his team. And so he really was interested in having me be a part of that sport. And so that's really what allowed me to run for Division I, honestly, because that was my secondary sport in high school. So I think coming into that environment in that position was also kind of unique in the sense that I didn't really identify as a distance runner. And here I was at a Division I program. And so I think that was kind of a setup too for some of the problems I faced.
Yeah, that's a big transition from like, I do this sport for fun and it's just like my kind of off season thing that I do, to now this is the whole thing that I do. And there are really high expectations and also a bigger talent pool and different styles of competition. Yeah, that's a lot.
I was running probably 25 miles a week in my high school program for track.
Yeah.
And I remember the coach that recruited me actually left the program the summer in the transition between high school and college. And so the head track coach was the ones in touch with the distance runners. He was the sprint coach and he gave us summer training. And I want to say, I remember it being like something like 80 miles a week. And I burst into tears. I panicked. I was like, how in the world am I going to be able to do this? You know, yeah. I think it was a very big transition that I was not prepared for on a lot of levels. But yes, I think going back to your earlier question, I ran cross country, indoor track and outdoor track. So I was competing all year round.
Yeah. And as you settled into that as lifestyle, as a student athlete running at that higher level, how did the sport or your relationship with the sport evolve during your college years?
Yeah. So I, because of my kind of naivete, and I do think there was naivete with the sport, but then also from an education perspective back, you know, that was in the late 90s. There was just a lot of lack of information as well around nutrition, around mental health, mental skills, all of those things. I wasn't a very equipped athlete going into that environment. So I would say like the things that were really driving me was my desire for success, my hard work ethic, my interest in really putting myself fully in the experience. And so what that meant for me as an athlete is that I really mirrored and mimicked the older athletes. So I was diligent in the training that my coach was giving me. And at that point another coach was hired for the distance team. So I was diligent in my training, and in terms of lifestyle and sort of behaviors outside of the training, I was really kind of watching the older teammates, particularly around just caring for my body through nutrition, sleep, all those things. I think I was just looking towards them and their role modeling for how to do it. And so that for me meant, you know, of course I didn't have any context for this at the time, but our program, most of the girls on the distance team were pretty disordered in the relationship with food. I don't know how many would be diagnosed with eating disorders, but it meant that I was training a lot of miles and not eating adequately and starting to get really, much more rigid and controlled and in my relationship with food. And this was coming off, actually, I did not have a disordered relationship with food in high school. I did sort of eat all foods, a very ease in my relationship with food. And then going into the program, it was like, oh, you do this as a runner. Like this is what you do. And you sort of, you know, slowly there was lots of things being cut out of my diet, and my body responded to that as like, this is a lot of runners' stories with the eating disorders. My body responded to that by losing weight. And then by, I want to say the end of my cross country season, I was already seeing like pretty significant results performance wise, where, you know, here I was a recruited walk on, and by my winter of indoor track, I was posting some of the fastest times on the team in the 1500. Wow. And I remember I didn't necessarily all totally attribute that to my weight loss and my eating. I remember also having like this spiritual experience of like, it's a miracle that I'm running this fast. But it was like, oh, these are the things I'm doing. I must continue these patterns because this is what is allowing, this is why I'm all of a sudden becoming so fast. And then in outdoor track, I mean, I was on the podium in Pac-10. So in the 3K and 5K. So I recruited walk-on basketball player to one of the top distance runners on the team by the end of my freshman year.
Wow. And then
there's so much detail I could say about this. So I don't know how to tell you what about my running career, but that was the start.
Okay. Well, I'm super curious and I really want to dig into that, but I also have lots of things I want to talk about. One thing I do want to ask is how your coaches, if at all, addressed like eating and body concerns, or if they had like preferences for how athletes were eating or what their body composition was like. Was that part of the conversation for you? No,
there was very little conversation. I remember we had, at that point, there was in the athletic department, there was no psychology resources. So no sports psychologist was hired by the athletic department. We had a 0.5 FTE dietitian for the whole athletic department. So we did have a dietitian come talk to our team winter of our indoor track season. And, you know, now there's so many thoughts I have about how this, and things have obviously shifted dramatically within, you know, UW sports athletic department. But at that time, I didn't listen to anything she said because I already had now my felt experience. I was the expert. I dismissed anything she was going to say about nutrition. So that education became pretty irrelevant to me at that point. And then in terms of any other guidance we had, I don't remember there being guidance. I don't remember any kind of preseason, you know, entering freshman information. We had to do our medical exams, but at that point I had a lot of great healthy markers from coming off of high school. And I do remember my PCP at the time, you know, I lost my period, became amenorrheic. It was you know, normalized by my PCP. It's because you're running so much, no big deal. Get on. And I went on birth control. Again, very common story for athletes at that time. So I was, you know, nothing was pointed out for concern from anything in my athletic, like there was no concern, even though the weight, like visible weight was dropping. I think that was people's, honestly, their expectation of how my body would shift going from basketball to a distance runner. So there was no expressing of concern. And then what I saw systemically on the team was there, I remember there was one girl that definitely had a more visible eating disorder in the sense that she was purging, and we'd go on road trips and she would purge, hide. I mean, this bit might be too much information, but essentially she would purge. There was a hiding of her purging XYZ. Her roommate brought that to the coach. We never heard any information after that of how that got addressed, what happened. She was still competing. So it was sort of the way I translated this. And this is, again, this isn't necessarily what my coach would have, the perspective of my coach, but my translation was, oh, this doesn't matter. Like, it's not a big enough concern to have it matter if we're not seeing any, we're not seeing any changes or hearing anything about it. So that was a pretty, again, like I was putting some of these pieces together later, but that was, oh, this isn't a big deal. I'm queuing off of coach. We're not going to be too worried. And then our eating patterns, I think what I remember quite often was we would do all these team meals together. The boys would go off and eat like with way more freedom and ease and eat lots of variety. And the girls would end up at Olive Garden for every competition and basically not eat enough and mimicked each other in our eating habits. And we never had, I don't remember coaches ever coming kind of to see what was happening at the table. So it was just sort of a very normalized. It was like, oh, this is just how it goes. And that was, I guess, how I was kind of taking it in as an athlete. Yeah.
A few things that you mentioned really stand out to me. One of them certainly being the dietitian coming to speak to you and, you know, late 90s. Maybe wouldn't have said anything super helpful anyway, other than like eat some carbs. Hopefully that was part of the message, but I feel like it's really common for folks to have some part of their story where they interacted with a quote unquote expert or a practitioner. I don't love the word expert, so we'll just say like an informed practitioner in a space, right? And want nothing to do with what they have to say because we are so conditioned to like model our behaviors off of the people that we want to be like.
Right.
Right. And so you see older athletes in your program doing these things. And so like, I think it's really common for folks to say like, well, this runner is doing this thing. I'm going to do that thing too. I don't care what this other person says because like, they don't know me. This is not a conversation. They're just like talking at me and I don't want to receive it.
And they're not a distance runner. So it's so easy to say, this doesn't apply to me. Right. Yeah. And of course now I have lots of different perspectives about that, but as an athlete at that time, that was an easy write-off, which is, I think, another reason I had interest in going into the field as somebody who had a lived experience as an athlete and wanting to be working with other distance. Like I had a lot of interest in working with distance runners for that whole legitimizing piece.
Yeah. And then also, I think it's so, I don't know, profound, I guess, to think about how there was somebody who had a concern about a teammate with an eating disorder, brought it forward. This person is still performing. There's no conversation about it. And from an athlete's perspective, it's like, one, this isn't a concern. Two, it doesn't matter. Three, she still gets to perform. So like, that's like the main motivator, right? Is like, I think maybe if there had been some intervention of like, maybe it's not safe for her to be performing right now or to be training right now, and the other athletes see that, then that can like change how you process that information and that occurrence or that event. But because of how it was handled, I can see where the processing of the information is more of like, okay, so we can like go to these extremes and maybe it will help us. And that's really all that matters is if we get a little bit faster.
Right. I like the way I would bring that, I would talk about that once I got into my professional life was really unpacking the power of silence. And especially when coaches, there's a reason for, there is some real concerns from coaches around, I don't want to say the wrong thing. I don't want to make a situation worse. I might not be educated enough to talk about this. And so there's fears. And again, I can't know what was going on in my own coach's head,
right?
But there's fears around speaking into these issues. But what a lot of times coaches don't realize is there's communication through not communicating. And then you're left to all of the athletes making their own interpretations of that silence for right. better or for worse. Right. So like it is communication. The non-communication is communication. And I think that's always something I want to really educate coaches on is, you know, please talk. Even if you screw up, you can come back and say you've screwed up, but don't be silent on these issues because they're body, food, periods, all these things are a regular part of an athlete's life, and they are going to be having to navigate it. So yeah.
Yeah. And
don't be silent.
I mean, the yeah. ego in like, well, I don't want to say the wrong thing, so we'll say nothing and we won't even reach out to see if someone else could maybe come talk about it. Like, understand if you feel like you're not qualified to address the issue, but then that doesn't mean the issue doesn't need to be addressed.
Exactly. And where are the athletes going to find that information now? Right. And nowadays, right. like there's so much accessible to athletes through their phone, through social media, through TikToks, through, you know, YouTube videos. So like they're going to find, they're, you know, they're trying to figure it out. And yeah. they're going to find information. So, yeah, I think it's really important for coaches. I think it's so important for coaches to have basic education regardless, and then be able to think through how they want to, how to like talk broadly about these things to the whole team, to the whole system.
Yeah. Protocol is helpful.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's fast forward a little bit. So you finish your collegiate athletic career and you decide to go into counseling, licensed marriage and family therapist. Is that right?
Yes.
So how did you decide with that training and education that you wanted to kind of come back into the athletic world and work with athletes?
Yeah. So I think when I made the decision, I was pre-med and my college experience. And then I actually had this really profound experience overseas in Israel that sort of was my light bulb moment of I really want to actually get into the field of mental health. And once I made that decision, I think I knew early on that I was hoping I could be like, I could do the work with athletes from the get-go. I wanted to do that. And so I actually chose a marriage and family therapy program because it's focused on systemic, looking at things through a systems lens. And I think that is always how I like that. That's how I see the world. That's how I see relationships. So family systems, sports systems, systems of, you know, our larger sociopolitical systems, our individual systems, our internal systems. That's my brain works that way. And so that's why I chose that path. But I knew I really did want to work with athletes. And I think there was, of course, some concern around my own recovery process. I was early in my recovery. Could I do this work? And would I be able to sustain my own recovery? How would that go for me? And so in my program, you know, there, for one, in our graduate school programs, there's very little education about eating disorders. So I was using any opportunity where I could research my own topic to learn as much as I could about eating disorders. So a lot of it was self-study within graduate school. And then population-wise, in my internship, there wasn't a lot of internship opportunities that would intersect with doing eating disorder work. So thankfully, we had this ability to do what it was called alternate hours. And we could use some of our face-to-face internship hours at an alternate site. And it had, yeah. So I basically reached out to Julie Church, who is now my co-founder of Opal.
Yeah.
There was like some friends in common and people were like, you need to get to know Julie, dietitian. And she was running a free support group at a local church for people that were struggling with eating disorders, open group, weekly group. And I asked her if I could co-facilitate that group with her. And it was such a cool experience because for me, it was sort of my test to see what it would be like to be around people sharing about their eating disorder and how would I react? And would that be triggering to, how would I do with that? And that was, and I got a, that was my entry into building a relationship with Julie.
Yeah.
And so her and I did this support group for a year, I want to say. And a lot of the people at that group were coming out of higher level of care treatment. So I was hearing lots of stories about eating disorders in the support group, obviously.
Yeah.
And I basically discovered that being around people talking about it was not turning out to be a setback for me or a way that was activating my own disorder thoughts, or it felt like it was only kind of bolstering and solidifying my recovery. And that was really encouraging. And so that was sort of like a helpful experience to say, yes, I'm going to do this work. And I kind of never looked back. I mean, I just went for it when I graduated and opened a private practice with Julie, worked in the SPU counseling center and worked with the athletic department at Seattle Pacific University. And, you know, really just my whole practice was with athletes.
How did the initial clients find you? Were you like working with student athletes as part of the university, or like what were some of your initial referral sources?
I mean, I think at the time, honestly, there were not a lot of people in the Seattle area that were working with athletes with eating disorders.
Yeah.
I was young. And so I think, you know, the folks that were more drawn to it, there was a lot of adolescent athletes and younger college age athletes. Just having that be on my website, that's the work I'm doing, a lot of people found me. Yeah, that practice built quickly. I think it was just a very big need because I was looking for community too. I was like, who else is doing this work? Who can I learn from? Who can I be in relationship with?
Yeah.
And, you know, there wasn't a lot back then in the Seattle area, surprisingly, but yeah, there wasn't. So
yeah,
I had a wait list quickly, basically.
Okay. And then you and Julie decide to build Opal, which is an eating disorder treatment center that incorporates movement and athletics into the treatment model and does so through a weight inclusive lens.
Yes.
I heard about Opal, I think in 17 or 2018. It was probably 2018.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point you had been open for 6 years, five
we
or six years?
We opened in 2012.
2012. Okay. How, I don't know, talk me through that process. Like, what were some of the early conversations about what would Opal look like and how would it be differentiated from other treatment models, which at the time, and still in some cases, movement is like, quote unquote, not allowed or like ill-advised. And so it can be hard, obviously, for someone with an athletic lifestyle or background to go into a treatment center and have that huge piece of their identity and their life taken out.
Right.
So yeah, tell me about those early conversations and how you decided to build it.
Yeah. So it's Julie, me, and our third co-founder is Lexi Giblin, who's a psychologist. And by the end of my last 4 years in outpatient care and practice, the three of us were sharing office space. So we learned that we were kind of doing a makeshift IOP. So we would do, you know, outpatient sessions and then run groups together. So philosophically, we were very aligned, especially in our weight inclusive care. And that was more radical back then. Health at every size was not as known as it is now, but we all came to that early, early in our careers and were very rooted in it and loved sharing clients. We loved working together. And also at that time, the only higher level of care in Seattle was an IOP program. And we didn't choose to refer very often to that program. So we were referring out of state a lot. And then having the discouraging experience over and over again of somebody coming back and feeling like we were cleaning up some of the work that the work, you know, the harmful things in our opinion that the treatment centers were doing around weight and not being weight inclusive. So coming back and, you know, having a weight range that was like a 5 pound weight range and then clients being terrified when they were over the weight range. Well, yes, of course you are, because that is not the kind of care we want to deliver. We did not believe in it at any stretch. So That's what really motivated us to open Opal, honestly, was that we just were not happy with the options. And there wasn't at the time, you know, something here. And then the year we decided to open is when all the other treatment centers came here. So Eating Recovery Center, Center for Discovery. So it was scary for us because we were taking this massive risk. None of us have backgrounds in business. We were not partnering with any business person. You know, we're three women opening this company. So, I mean, it was, it's kind of nutty what we did when we look back, but then here's all these other people coming into Seattle. We're like, are we even going to have a feasible business? So the weight inclusive piece was really by far sort of our line in the sand. That was with our hiring, we were only going to bring people that shared that philosophy. And again, at that time, it was a little bit more radical. And then the sport piece was really my baby. Like that was, I guess I would say I didn't talk about my recovery process, but I really feel like my eating disorder manifested in my exercise much more intensely than in my relationship with food. Like in my recovery process, it was easier in a lot of ways for me to do the work on food. The exercise was harder. And so it was such a big part of my recovery process. And I didn't have treatment providers that could really guide me in that. And so I did a lot of my own experimentation on myself. And then I was bringing that into my outpatient practice. And I was just excited about what the change I saw in myself, the shift, this transformation I could see in myself. And then I was seeing in others. I was like, I want to create a program that does that. And I mean, I just, their belief was so strong, and I'm pretty innovative and creative and risk-taking. And of course, though, you know, if you look like at the time, I think a lot of the fears in higher level of care was it wasn't medically safe to do that. When you're in higher level of care, what about, you know, you're taking a lot of risk of letting people do movement or exercise in higher level of care. So that was a fear. And then the other thing was the bias around in the mental health field and the eating disorder field. If you've been disordered in your sport, you're going to just have to quit it. Like there, you can't transform that. So that was a pretty strong bias in the field paired with the fear of medical safety. Physical safety. So, and I'm a risk taker, but you know, I think what also helped is that there was another program at the time that was introducing this, and that was the Victory program in St. Louis. And I became kind of friends with Ron Thompson. I met him at conferences, and I'm like running up to him at a conference, like, can I know you? Let's be friends. and he meant to help mentor me. So I think there was mentorship there. Their program was also doing it, and that kind of helped us feel like we weren't doing something kind of wrong. So they had started their Victory program around the same time as Opal. And then we were working, we worked on all of those things around clearance and medical safety. And then I didn't hold the bias that you can't transform your relationship, because my relationship was completely transformed. Yeah. And so, you know, when we opened, now our programming is, you know, it's expanded quite a bit, but at the beginning, at the get-go, we started off with, sort of our program, our exercise and sport programming, and then it's evolved over time.
Yeah. I want to go back to what you said about the perception being that if your behaviors manifest in a disordered relationship to sport or exercise, we take that thing away, and let's like change exercise to food. Like we can't just take food away, right? Like we need it.
Right.
Why is the same logic like not applied to movement?
I don't understand that. Yeah. I think that's the piece around like the, why would we incorporate it? I don't understand why we wouldn't, because that is a part of who we are as humans. We are movers. We are embodied. And I think maybe some of that is thinking about movement and exercise in a more narrow perspective of just seeing it kind of as intentional exercise for the running or the gym.
Yeah.
But the way that we see it is who we are in our bodies. We see it from a much bigger perspective of what counts as who we are as movers. And so how would we not address that? And what clients were saying is it just wasn't talked about in higher level of care. And then they were left to, you know, then they're in outpatient care and left to their own exploration. And I didn't want, Like that's not necessary. We don't have to do that. It doesn't need to happen.
And I think that speaks a little bit to the ways in which a lot of more, I guess, traditional treatment models ignore or like don't really prepare folks for what's going to happen when they go back to real life.
Right.
And you can say while you're in treatment, you can't have any movement, you can't exercise, et cetera. And then folks go back to their real life and they might miss that for any number of reasons, if not dozens of reasons, and they are going to want it back and they're going to have no tools to reaccess right. it.
Totally. And I would also say that one of the things, because I do a lot of also kind of community facing learning, I think that what we do in our programming and how we're developing people applies to everyone, not just folks with eating disorders, because again, I think there's a major gap in our society around building people's relationship with exercise, sport, and movement. Like I think of PE, you know, I have two teenage daughters. I think of what I saw in their standard PE and health curriculum in the education system. And I say it's similar for food. It's like, there's a lot of attention around kind of what you're doing, what you're eating, what are you doing for exercise and how much you're exercising. But there's no attentiveness to the relationship of those things, the how, the mindset, how are you approaching these things? And I mean, I can't tell you how many times we have conversations here at Opal where clients are like, I've never thought about that before. I've never thought about that. I've never considered that. And there's more in the eating disorder world, more development around that, around food. But then, you know, we have clients that are transferring here from other programs, other eating disorder programs, and they'll say, I just have never thought about that with exercise or movement. I'm like, yeah, because usually families don't talk about this, communities, schools certainly don't. So I think it's kind of growing people. It's like helping growing people in their relationship to movement. How do we think about it? How do we develop outside of these really narrow channels?
Yeah. And we've talked about this before a few years ago on a previous episode, and we don't have a lot of time to dig into it today, but one of my favorite things that we've talked about is how some of our needs are met through exercise and just how to explore exercise being a thing that gives so much to us and like how we feel about that, you know, and it's different for everybody. But prior to our conversation about that, I don't know, when was that? Maybe 2020? Like, I feel like I just didn't have the language for that. And I really appreciated having the language for exercise as a means of self-exploration, self-expression, self-appreciation, and community and connection and like expanding your worldview. Like, there's just so many things. And culturally, and in a lot of our education systems, we think of like sports or exercise as like you either participate on a team and you do this thing for competition and performance, or you do this thing because you're supposed to, because it's quote unquote healthy, and that's it. And there's no
exploration outside of that.
Yeah.
And like you're saying, I really appreciate you saying that, because I think one of the things that we're doing is making something unconscious conscious so that people can know more, because if you're making it conscious, then you have more direction of how to grow something, turn the volume up on something, turn the volume down on something.
Yeah.
You have some place to go with it. So like a good example would be if we bring into our conversation important human needs, we write, you know, we give the clients a list of probably 25 human needs and have them examine that. And often what they're recognizing, especially from people in sport experiences, is how many human needs often are met through sport, especially early on in youth athletics, kind of early entry into sports. So many of these needs get met. And kind of, again, making something unconscious conscious, recognizing that. And then often for our clients, the journey is as sports get more intense, get higher level in athletics, oftentimes those needs get narrowed into highlighting and focusing on particular needs.
Yeah.
And then that's where some of the problems can start to come. And so, okay, let's learn that. Now, how with that, how might we expand the needs within the sport, also look at how is this balance between in sports meeting needs and outside of sports, and where might we want to do some work on balancing that? So again, it's making these ideas, it's like those things are already exist, but people aren't conscious of it. And yeah. So there's, it's hard to grow and make change when you don't know what you don't know.
Right. Yeah. So. And no one, like, you've just never even heard any sort of like emotional need and exercise and sport put into context for you. So it's like, just, yeah, right. I just put together a few pieces of my own story while you were talking. That's like sort of blowing my mind right now, but we'll come back to that some other time.
I love that.
I'm curious, are coaches and or other athletic support staff ever involved in the treatment process for athletes? So I know there have been some like very high level athletes, meaning like professional athletes that have come through Opal, like folks who do it as part of their job. And then, you know, I'm sure that like the clients that you see are on the spectrum, much like within our community of like, we do it for fun or we did it in high school and we do it professionally and there's everything in between. So yeah, are there any support staff or kind of coaches and leaders involved in their process?
Yes. If a client is, and this isn't actually as common as one might think, that we have clients that are coming in that are currently, currently engaged, because we have 18 and over clients. So clients that are currently engaged in sport that are on a team, that is probably a small percentage of our client population, but the ones that are currently taking a break from their team or on a team. Yes, we are working with a client around whether we can engage with the coach, but there's a lot of encouragement to do that, to involve the coach in that process for sure. And we've had some really, really amazing positive experiences working with coaches who are open-minded and want to learn and are very invested in their athlete's health and well-being. So I think that's actually been a neat piece to witness. And then of course there's, I think actually probably what we hear more of in terms of maybe negative coaching experiences is more in the past experiences for our clients. Yeah. But yeah, we are engaging the coach for sure.
Awesome. Yeah. And then I have so many other questions to ask you, but we're running short on time. So one thing I'd love to hear a little bit more about too is how the Opal process starts to prepare folks for like the post-treatment life. Because as we alluded to earlier, a lot of what I've seen as in my previous life as a private practice owner and working outpatient and seeing a lot of folks who had been in treatment before, or maybe were like transitioning out of treatment. There's just a huge shift between like, I have all this care and all these appointments and this community and this group therapy, et cetera. And then I'm just like back in my real life. Mm-hmm. And I have to find my own care a lot of times. I have to set up my own appointments. I have to build it into my week where I'm working or I'm back in school or I'm back to training or whatever. So what are some of the ways that you all kind of help folks prepare for that transition, or I guess maybe even support them through that time?
Well, ideally, and what most of us are doing is right when they're actually coming, we're already thinking about that transition to outpatient and building a strong outpatient team. And, you know, some people are coming in with that outpatient team already, or if they're not, or if they need a change in their outpatient team to better serve them, we're working on that from the get-go because that is so key in that transition. It's always rocky going from higher level care into outpatient. And so making sure they're with a strong team. And in terms of like the sport and exercise work, I think that they, a lot of times they're getting that throughout their treatment experience at Opal. And if there are, especially for those that's a big piece of their identity and a big part of their work, we're also connecting them with outpatient community providers that can still support them in that. So we're always building our resource list and who our coaches even. I mean, we work with a lot of distance runners, I think because of my sport experience and some of the people we've hired. So we have some even coaches that we can work with an outpatient, and then even providers that have worked at Opal that have been trained here that are now in private practice that could still do some of that one-to-one movement work. If that's really still important, especially if they haven't reached full clearance while they've been in higher level of care, maybe they've only reached partial clearance. And so I think that's the main piece, is just being very thoughtful from the get-go around that outpatient, that transition and the outpatient care that they need.
Yeah. All right. We're going to do our last lap questions.
Okay.
Okay. If you could have one song played along the course during the final mile or lap of a race, what do you pick?
Okay. I had to think about this one because I'm actually not a huge music person, but I do, if I can listen to music when I'm racing, I do like it. So I like Drake.
Yes.
So Nice for What is the one. I'd say Nice for What's a good, it has a good beat.
Yes. I've recently gotten into the playlists on Spotify that have like a, it's like 165 to 180 beats per minute to help with cadence. And it actually is very helpful.
Yes.
But I like to listen to what I know. So I'm having a hard time, like, there's combining. One in particular that's just a mix of songs, most of which I've never heard before. So I'm getting used to it. But yeah, those are really helpful. A nice beat goes a long way.
A nice beat is pretty major. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Do you prefer group runs, solo runs, or friend runs, and why?
So it depends because of my human needs.
Yeah.
You know, what do I want? What is my need? Do I, you know, I think I could do, I partake in all of it. And it varies depending on, yeah, mood, need, all of it. So I like them all. It's season of life dependent, human need dependent, but
I love that answer. Human need dependent. Yeah. I like to have a little mix of all of the above, but some people are really strongly in one camp or the other. So, all right. What running item or brand should sponsor you because you're constantly singing their praises to friends?
So Wazelle. So they're Seattle.
Yeah.
I do really sing their praises. They're it's, I think the challenge with Wazelle is that it's, the price point is high. So the access in that way is challenging, but from a female bodied perspective, like the fit, especially the shorts, there's like nothing. I think they're so comfortable.
Yeah.
I love the material. I love the comfort. I'm a big Wazelle fan.
I just purchased two of their sports bras. I'm forgetting the name of like the design, but I'm a huge Lauren Fleshman fan and she posted about them and they have a little cell phone pocket in the back. And I was like, sold.
Done.
Cool. And they have wider shoulder straps. So you could wear it in the summer with a vest, which has always been the issue for me. I'm not really a sports bra runner, kind of aspire to be, but especially in the summer here. But I do wear a vest for long runs and I'm like, the chafing would just unravel me. So.
They kind of think of everything. I just do think they're just having the female body and mind and comfort and creativity. I just, it's there. Yeah. It's awesome. In Seattle, they have a sample sale. So I like to go to the sample sale because then it's more affordable.
Yes. And the flagship store is in Seattle, right?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. All right. What's a running moment in or outside of racing that you feel deeply proud of or stands out to you for any reason?
Yeah. The first thing that comes to mind with that is we have partnered and done some work with Allison Mariella Desir, and her and I have built a friendship and a relationship, and we've done some neat professional experiences together. And when I read her book, Running While Black, I think one of my convictions was that just like, I don't step out of my comfort zone very often when it comes to who I'm running with. And I had a bit outside of my athletic experience, I didn't do a lot of group running. Like I would run with friends, but it was mostly like one-on-one. And so I heard for various reasons about CSRD. So it's Club Running Seattle Division.
Yeah.
It was started by Ashley Davies. And I chose to get out of my comfort zone and go to their group run, you know, by myself without a friend, which was pretty scary because that's, you know, it's not, I'm an introvert. That felt like I didn't know anyone there.
Yeah.
And so I'm proud of myself for doing that. And then I've continued to show up to that running group. It's amazing. She creates a very inclusive space. I'm running with people that are very way different life stages and
Yeah.
again, different races and different bodies. You know, it's just like a very much more diverse group than we typically find in running community spaces. And so I'm proud of myself for stepping out of my comfort zone by not knowing
Yes.
anyone and showing up. And I always feel really blessed when I'm there.
Yeah, I love that. I need to find a running group here, and that's motivating to me. I have some friends, but I haven't done the group thing yet. So, all right. Thank you so much for joining us, Kara. I'm sure this will be the first of maybe a few podcast episodes that we do here because there's so much to talk about. But I really appreciate you sharing your story and also sharing more about Opal and the work that you're doing there, which I've always found so incredible and inspiring. And I know it's so needed. So, thank you for all of that.
Yeah, thanks.